It was one of the fiercest battles in the history of warfare, pitting nearly 70,000 U.S. Marines and sailors against more than 20,000 Japanese Imperial Army defenders in the penultimate combat of World War II. I'm Oliver North, and this is the story of the vicious fight for Iwo Jima, a tiny volcanic island just 5 miles long and 2.5 miles across at its widest. From 19 February to 26 March 1945, it was a cauldron of fire that claimed the lives of nearly 7,000 Americans and all but a handful of the dug-in Japanese defenders. In this, the very first episode of our award-winning War Stories series, you'll hear in this podcast from eyewitness participants in this epic battle. Fred Haynes, who went on to become a major general in the U.S. Marines, but on D-Day at Iwo, he was an infantry captain, and his hair-raising account of the landing is the stuff of legend. Donald Mates from Cleveland, Ohio, was a Marine private on Iwo. He'll tell you how he was wounded 3 times in a space of an hour and was just one of 2 survivors from his 10-man patrol. Almost everyone's seen the famous picture of the flag being raised on Mount Suribachi. Now, in this podcast, you can hear Marine Lieutenant Greeley Wells, the man who actually carried ashore the first flag planted atop that volcano. Of the 6 men in Joe Rosenthal's Pulitzer Prize-winning photo, 3 were killed in action within days. One of the brave Marines captured in the photo carried a picture of his girlfriend inside the webbing of his helmet. You'll learn whether he made it home to see her again. How was the flag-raising picture taken? Was it staged? Find out the whole story and hear what it was like to fight a war in a place the Marines say was hell with a fire out.
Uncommon valor was a common virtue. 6 deceptively simple words describing these 6 boys and the 80,000 others who fought in one of the fiercest and most controversial battles in World War II. Good evening. I'm Oliver North, and welcome to War Stories. This Marine memorial here in our nation's capital was inspired by the frozen image of battle captured in 1/400th of a second. 6 boys planting the American flag on foreign soil. It was 36 of the bloodiest days of combat in American history. 2 out of every 3 boys who landed on this 8-square-mile island were killed or wounded. Nearly all of the 22,000 Japanese defenders died. To put that in perspective, with nearly 7,000 killed in action, if the battle at Iwo Jima had lasted 9 months, it would have equaled all those killed in 10 years of my war, Vietnam. More than 50 years after this battle, questions still remain and controversies still rage.
1939, while America was still recovering from the Great Depression, the World's Fair came to New York, Lou Gehrig said goodbye, and Miss Scarlet kissed Rhett Butler. But across the Atlantic, Europe was engulfed in war. For 2 years, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt did his best to assure America's nervous mothers and fathers that he'd not lead the country into war.
That I have seen war and that I hate war. I hope the United States will keep out of this war. I believe that it will.
But on December 7th, 1941, it all changed. America was attacked on its own shores by a new enemy, Japan. Under a harsh military regime, Japan had been at war since 1931. With no natural resources, the country was intent on making itself a world power and had stormed into Manchuria and China. Stateside, Adolf Hitler had been the enemy America feared, while Japan was largely ignored. But after the Day of Infamy, America found itself in a two-ocean war. Across the Atlantic, we joined the Allied troops fighting the Germans. But against Japan, America would stand virtually alone in the Pacific.
Pay enough clothes for 3 days. 50 a month is all it pays. Pay enough clothes for 3 days. And don't bring no sad excuse.
All wars are boyish and are fought by boys. So wrote Herman Melville, and that's the way it was with the six flag raisers.
There's four guys in the front, two in the back.
James Bradley, author of the best-selling Flags of Our Fathers, got to know each of the boys intimately. That included learning about his own father, John Doc Bradley.
If you look at the flag-raising photo from the front, my dad is not the guy putting the pole in the ground. He's the next guy up.
At 19, from Appleton, Wisconsin, Doc was a Navy corpsman assigned to treat wounded Marines in battle.
If you look behind my father, obscured by my father, you'll see a helmet poking out. That's the helmet of René Gagnon from Manchester, New Hampshire. If you took that helmet off at the moment that René was in that photo and reached inside, you'd find a picture stuffed in the webbing of his helmet. That was a picture of René's girlfriend. He put it there because he felt he needed protection. René was scared. René was 18 years old. Harlan Block, the guy putting the pole in the ground, enlisted in the United States Marine Corps with all the senior members of his football team. 13 guys taking the oath. They were off to another game called war.
At 18 years old, Harlan was a hardscrabble oil worker from Westlake, Texas.
There's another Marine obscured in the back. It's my hero, Mike Strank. He was the sergeant. They called him the old man because he was already old and grizzled. He was 24 years old. If you examine the photo closely, you'll see that Mike's right hand is not on the pole. His left hand's on the pole. His right hand comes around and is around the wrist of a younger boy. And that's typical of Mike, the Marine sergeant, helping the younger boy with that heavy pole in the chain of battle.
That boy was Franklin Sousley from Hilltop, Kentucky. Fun is the word most often used to describe the 19-year-old good old boy who enjoyed playing practical jokes.
Franklin Sousley, when he said goodbye to his mother for the last time, he said, "Don't worry, when I come back, I'll be a hero." The last guy on the photo, the guy whose hands do not reach the pole, that's a distinguished Pima Indian from Arizona, Ira Hayes, and was acclaimed as a hero. President Truman called him a hero to his face in the Oval Office in front of my father. Ira didn't see it that way. How can I feel like a hero when 250 of my buddies hit the beach with me and only 27 of us walked off alive?
These boys formed a representative snapshot of what America was like in the 1940s.
Marines criticized me for using the word boys, and I said, "I'm sorry, sir. I think your mother thought you were a boy out there at the age of 18 on Iwo Jima." Boys won the Battle of Iwo Jima.
In March 1944, a river of young boys, more than 21,000, including the six flag raisers, poured into California's Camp Pendleton. Ira, Doc, Franklin, Harlan, René, and Mike became part of Company E, known as Easy Company.
Easy Company was a company of about 250 guys, and their job was to go out and fight.
I was sent as one of the, happened to be novices, because I hadn't been in combat, and I arrived there. And I was a day late, and I went before my colonel, Chandler Johnson, and he looked me over and said, "You're a day late." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "I'm going to make you my adjutant, and you're going to rue the day, report on time tomorrow." I didn't know anything about being an adjutant. I read the manual, and the very end it says, "And the adjutant carries a flag." And somebody said, "Why the flag?" And I said, "I don't know, but I'll have it if you need it."
That flag that's right behind you.
Yes, and with the hopes that maybe we would be the outfit that would put the flag up.
But where would the battle be fought? It was a top-secret location known only as Island X.
General, one of the great controversies over this whole battle, and there's many, but one of them is that we really didn't know how strong the Japanese were on the island, how many there were even.
We didn't know. That's a very good point. And the estimate in late 44 was that there were about 11,000 Japanese on the island. There were actually about 22,000.
They said it was like hell with a fire out. Now, meet the enemy they faced, the fierce Japanese defenders of Iwo Jima, next on War Stories.
Let's examine a typical Japanese soldier. His average height is 5 feet 3 inches. His average weight, 117 pounds. He and his brother soldiers are as much alike as photographic prints off the same negative.
After the attack on Pearl Harbor, the U.S. government used films to educate its troops about the Japanese.
The United States was fairly naive. To put it mildly, we thought of them as just myopic, inept, and the cartoon caricatures of them portrayed them as monkeys.
Bradley J. Hartzell is a retired Marine Staff Sergeant who both speaks and writes Japanese. He's worked both on Okinawa and Iwo Jima as the guest of the Japanese and U.S. governments searching for the remains of the more than 16,000 dead Japanese soldiers entombed in tunnels on Iwo Jima. He studied war propaganda on both sides of the conflict.
At one point, there was even discussions in our military that the Japanese would not be good jungle fighters because they didn't have good night vision, or they couldn't be good pilots because they had such poor eyesight.
The fusion of all these tribes and races resulted in the Japanese of today, not of one pure blood, but of a well-mixed plasma cocktail.
I would attribute most of that to U.S. arrogance at that point. But once the Japanese marched across the Pacific and we finally entered into some engagements with them, we learned quite quickly that they were very well trained, very well equipped, and they weren't these inept, quote, monkeys.
They were fearless. They were some fighting men. I've got to give them credit. They were inspired. It was part of their homeland.
The Japanese soldier had been ingrained for a long time in that whole mindset of the code of the samurai. So when it came time for them to go into battle, they weren't fearful of dying. And it was thought of as a cherry blossom falling off the cherry tree.
If he surrendered, he could be shot by his own people, number one. But number two, worse, that poor Japanese soldier was dishonored back in the village. His name would be ripped out of the village rolls. His parents would be dishonored. There was no surrender. World War II in Europe was a war of rules. Intensely fought, but there were rules. They took timeouts. They collected each other's dead. In the Pacific, no rules.
For Japanese children, war was a way of life.
In Japan, children were indoctrinated at an early age into the role of the military. This is a representation of a children's game. So the child would have had to start in this fashion, and then by manipulating the anti-aircraft guns, work the aircraft over the bombing point.
The average age of a Japanese soldier in World War II was a battle-hardened 24. For the Americans, it was 19, with many boys seeing combat for the very first time. But for three of the flag raisers, Mike Strank, Harlan Block, and Ira Hayes, the Japanese were a familiar enemy. With 14,000 other Marines, they'd met at the Battle of Bougainville in 1943.
Belonging. Pride in being a Marine.
And what did the Japanese know about the Marines?
In order to become a U.S. Marine, an American had to kill his parents. And it was also told to them that Marines ate dead babies. They also told the civilians that if they were to be taken prisoner by the U.S., the women would be raped and killed and their children would be slaughtered and eaten. Oftentimes, as the advances pushed them into a farther corner of an island, they would throw their children off the cliffs and then throw themselves off after their children to commit suicides.
The responsibility for destroying the Americans at Iwo Jima was given to this man, General Tadamichi Kuribayashi. He was personally selected by Emperor Hirohito. Standing 5 feet 9 inches, Kuribayashi had led his troops to victories in Manchuria and China. But he knew America was a different enemy, having lived in the U.S. as a military attaché.
He actually lived in upstate New York with a woman that he described as a very fat woman, who was very kind to him, as a matter of fact. But he also had the opportunity to travel throughout the United States and view the economic might. And he made the statement that the last country Japan should ever go to war with was the United States.
They are battle-wise.
Leading the American troops was another hand-picked general, General Howland Mad Smith.
Our men want to win this war and win it fast.
He was selected by President Roosevelt, nicknamed the Patton of the Pacific. Smith and his Marines had never lost a battle where a Marine boot stepped ashore.
Colonel, this is a great installation.
Colonel John Ripley is the holder of the Navy Cross, our nation's second highest award for valor. Now, as the director of the Marines History and Museums Division, he's analyzed the battle strategies of the two generals.
President Roosevelt, and I think it's true of the American people, the whole American public, had presumed this would be pretty much another washover Iwo Jima. Yes, it would cost Americans, but they had not prepared themselves for the ferocity, the intensity, the extraordinary numbers of casualties.
To General Kuribayashi, a heroic fight meant that every one of his soldiers would die. But each man was told to kill 10 Americans first before they died. Stay with me, Oliver North, here on Fox News War Stories.
February 14th, 1945. 800 ships are en route to combat on Island X. It's the largest armada in naval history at the time. Aboard ship, the men receive communion and write letters home.
We had no idea where we were going.
It was lovely weather. It was a cruise. We slept on deck.
D-Day in the Pacific was 4 days away, and it would be nothing like its European counterpart some 8 months earlier.
Anytime a bullet is near your head, that's a bad battle. Normandy was awful. Normandy lasted 24 hours. At the end of 24 hours, you and your grandmother could have a tea party on the beach of Normandy. Iwo Jima, much smaller beach, 36-day battle on a 5-mile-long island. Absolutely the most intense battle of World War II.
Why were these islands so important?
The islands were a systematic approach through what the Japanese called the inner and the outer ring of their defenses. It became the winning strategy of the war to go directly toward Japan, establish air bases from which eventually we could take the war in a very major way, the air war to Japan.
Iwo Jima meant Sulphur Island. It was a stinking hulk of volcanic rock 650 miles south of Tokyo and part of the Japanese Empire. Its only notable features were Mount Suribachi, an extinct volcano, and two crucial airfields. The U.S. needed landing fields for planes returning from bombing runs that were damaged or running out of fuel. Too many pilots were being sent to a watery grave.
For every Marine that was lost, one air crew was saved. 25,000 airmen managed to live to fight again because of the 25,000 Marines that took Iwo Jima.
Key to the invasion was 72 consecutive days of bombing by B-29 Superforts and B-24 Liberators. Iwo Jima would set the record for the most sustained and heavy bombardment in all the Pacific War. More than 5,800 tons were dropped. And the Navy backed them up.
And we just stayed offshore for 5 or 6 days. This huge guns sending those shells that weighed probably a ton or more through the air and see them land and go off with tremendous explosions that seemed to shoot flame and smoke and dust up two or three or four stories high, and the sound of them was overpowering. You could not believe that anybody could possibly live through that. But of course, we didn't know that they were doing quite well.
The unthinkable was happening. General Howland Mad Smith observed Kiribayashi's defenses were growing, not being pulverized. What was happening?
The Japanese were underground in a fault city on a five-mile-long island, had 16 miles of tunnels, 1,500 separate rooms connected by these tunnels. They could run through the tunnels with rifles standing up. They had electricity, ventilation systems. They were ready to stay for months.
I think they went down to lower tunnels and just laid down there, and we bombed our heart out, and we really didn't accomplish too much.
No one has a sense for how they're also digging in underneath this entire island.
Nobody really knew.
Then a 24-year-old captain in the Marines, General Fred Haines, was the operations officer for the 28th Marine Regiment as the showdown on Iwo Jima's beaches drew near.
And I don't say that's a failure of intelligence. We did not really wake up to the fact until after we had gone ashore.
All the bombing did is rearrange the sand. When the Marines hit the beach, the 22,000 Japanese literally came alive and dealt them deadly blows.
What lesson did the Japanese General Kiribayashi learn from the German mistakes at Normandy? Was this famous flag raising staged? See the answer yourself next on War Stories.
It was a lovely cruise going there. The morning that we woke up and had steak and eggs for breakfast, we knew we were going ashore.
D-Day, February 19th, 1945, 9:05 a.m. The first troop carrying Amtraks land on the black sands of Iwo Jima. For the next hour, it was a flawless landing. But it was part of General Kiribayashi's plan, something he learned from the German mistakes at Normandy.
He withheld his defense from the beach until he had the landing force ashore.
Then all hell broke loose. Listen to the sounds of the battlefield that were broadcast on radio.
There's all hell to pay directly ahead of us. The beach looks as though it's practically on fire.
Donald Mates was a reconnaissance scout observer.
It was just chaos. It was broken equipment and broken men. They were in the water, they were on the beach, they were on the rise coming from the beach. There were parts of the men all over. And it was just bedlam, just absolutely bedlam. I can't describe it to you. All I can think of was it's not the movies.
For the first 72 hours, there was a casualty every three quarters of a minute.
From inside cement pillboxes like this one, the Japanese were protected underground assassins. And Mount Suribachi revealed itself as a seven-story killing machine.
It's almost unbelievable. Everything on Iwo Jima is underground.
From there, the Japanese unleashed spigot mortars, which could hurl a 675-pound shell nearly three-quarters of a mile. General Kiribayashi's men mowed down the Marines like a buzzsaw.
Every square foot of that invasion beach had interlocking sectors of fire where machine gun fire and small arms fire would crisscross.
The mission of the two assault battalions, one is to cut this part of the island off.
Right.
The other battalion, 2nd Battalion, to take
them out.
Mount Suribachi.
Correct.
But it was an impossible task during those first few days of fighting. The Japanese had terraced the beach, forcing the Marines to try to dig into the coarse black sand. Wearing 75-pound packs, it was like digging a hole in a bowl of marbles. The reality was that your only protection was often the body of your fallen comrade.
With me was Jimmy Trimble, the baseball pitcher for the Washington Senators. We had maneuvered ourselves to be in front of the lines. And the Japanese came up out of their holes, and it was hand to hand. I was laying out flat when I heard the word grenades, and Jimmy Trimble was sitting up. He turned, and he caught the full blast of one of the grenades, and back, and one went off between my legs. I pulled myself out of the hole, and Trimble was still alive, and he put his hand out to be helped out. At the same time, a Japanese soldier jumped in with a mine strapped to his body and wrapped himself around Jimmy. The Japanese soldier just evaporated.
I think my dad probably held 200 young American boys in his arms as they died in Iwo Jima. My dad was a corpsman. And when you're holding dying young boys in Iwo Jima, they're screaming for their mothers and they're struggling in pain. This is something you want to forget.
Night brought a new kind of hell. Mount Suribachi resembled a monstrous Christmas tree, and down below, General Kuribashi sent out his prowling wolves to wreak havoc.
When that sun went down, you better get the flares up because they came out. They came right at you. They were some night fighters. Tell you what I saw that is still scary to me today. The Japanese that were infiltrating into our lines and were coming past our outpost wore little phosphorus buttons on the back of their uniform. As they infiltrated, their officer would call directions to the left, to the right, and they could spot one another. But as they were coming toward you, you could not see them.
And that first night, I went on a foxhole, and Gagnon was the runner from Easy Company.
Private First Class Rene Gagnon.
Right. And he spent the night with me, and in the morning, I woke up, and he was praying. And I said, I thought you weren't such a good Catholic. And he said, well, you know, Lieutenant, it's been a tough night.
The Marines kept pushing, attacking the pillboxes with flamethrowers and Zippo tanks and grenades to drive out the Japanese. Many times, all it did was drive them deeper underground to fight another day.
Consider that my father landed 400 yards from Mount Suribachi. 4 days to go that 400 yards.
D plus 4, February 23rd. In the morning, Navy planes napalm Mount Suribachi. At its base, Colonel Chandler Johnson orders a 40-man combat patrol, including Doc Bradley and Marine photographer Lou Lowry, up the volcano's slopes.
Captain Severns of F Company was there, and as he recorded, he felt a dread that he was sending his men, they'd be absolutely slaughtered.
But the mountain was strangely quiet that morning.
The colonel turned and said, Wells, have you got the flag?
Now, that flag was the one that you had taken from the USS Missoula.
Right. We all were holding our breath because everything had been so severe, so intense. They said that later on they found hundreds of men who had committed suicide.
Using a water pipe, they found a patrol attached the flag. And at 10:20 a.m., the Stars and Stripes flew over Japanese territory for the first time in history. Lowry snapped several photos, and the whistles blew.
I was about 150 meters back here watching it.
It was just noise, whistles and toots and shouts and cheering. And it was just to see Old Glory flying there was just marvelous.
Whenever I look at the American flag, I get choked up. And I think it was a big release and a false thought. The battle's almost over.
But there were 32 days of brutal combat still ahead. Down below, Colonel Johnson thought the flag on top of Suribachi ought to be bigger. He sent Rene Gagnon to carry one measuring 96 by 56 inches. Around noon, Mike Strank, Harlan Block, Ira Hayes, and Franklin Sousley were also ordered up the mountain to set up a communications post. Joining them were some photographers who had missed the first flag raising. They still wanted pictures.
Bob Campbell, Marine photographer, Bill Ganoust, who had a movie film camera, and Joe Rosenthal, a civilian photographer, walked up Mount Suribachi, and in a happenstance way, we're lucky enough to get the shot of the second flag going up.
I went up, and I was late.
I was late by, well, at least an hour, hour and a half.
Joe Rosenthal was dealing with a large, bulky speed graphic camera, and he was stacking sandbags trying to get set, and all of a sudden in the distance, the flag started to go up. The guy next to him, Bill Ganau, said, "There goes Joe." Joe grabbed this camera, swung it, and when he thought it was at the peak of the action, he clicked. It was like getting Michael Jordan in midair.
None of us made any effort to set it up. It's not a set-up picture. I had nothing to do with the location that that pole was placed. I did not give a signal as to when it would go up.
The boys struggled with a pole that weighed more than 150 pounds to put the flag up. Nobody noticed or cheered.
Rene Gagnon Jr. told me that his father told him raising the flag that day was about as significant as going to the mailbox. So the famous photo that we all know on Iwo Jima was a replacement flag, extremely insignificant. Joe never saw the shot. He did not see the flag raising because he had just swung the camera quickly. He thought he missed a good shot. So he asked the lieutenant after the flag was up, "Could you pose some guys underneath that?" So 18 guys posed in a photo that I call a gung-ho photo. And they're waving to the camera. And Joe thinks he's got this great shot for the hometown folks. Well, 2 days later, the AP wires him. Remember, this is 1945. It isn't like the internet where Joe's going to see, you know, his shot. They say, "Congratulations on the great photo. Joe, did you pose it?" And Joe said, "Yes, of course," thinking of the gung-ho posed photo. But there begins the myth that the flag raising was posed.
It would win the Pulitzer Prize and become the most recognized and reproduced image in history.
Next on War Stories, three of these boys come home and are called to another challenging task, fame and celebrity. In some ways, an even more difficult challenge.
The president saw these casualty figures for the very first time. I believe that was D+2. He gasped and then he wept. He couldn't believe the report that we had lost that many men in just 2 days ashore.
Nearly 4,200 Marines were wounded, more than 640 dead, another 560 missing in action. The Marines were coming to grips with a painful reality. The enemy was not on, but rather in Iwo. Prowling the 16 miles of tunnels were Kuribayashi's men. They were like phantoms with guns, remembers then-private John Cole.
They were shooting from holes in the ground, from caves, from pillboxes, every imaginable place, and a lot of them you would never think to look at. They were marvelously concealed. And I know a lot of wounded men who never saw the men who shot them. Never.
As a Navy corpsman, Doc Bradley's job was to attend a never-ending stream of injured and dying men. But one death deeply affected him.
I was a 13-year-old pimpled high school student sitting up watching Johnny Carson late one night with my dad. And out of the blue, I just decided to ask him about Iwo Jima for probably the 300th time. I'd never gotten anywhere. I mean, can't you tell me anything? And at that moment, his head went back on the rocker, and he goes, "Jeez, I've tried so hard to black this out." And with his eyes closed, he just described the fact that he went into the service with a buddy, Ralph Ignatowski, who they called Iggy from Milwaukee. And Iggy was his close buddy. Well, Iggy disappeared one day in the battle. My dad couldn't find him. 3 days later, his body was coughed back up. The Japanese had grabbed Iggy, taken him underground, and tortured him for 3 days. So he was called over to examine the horribly mutilated body. I'm sure this contributed to my dad's silence on Iwo Jima.
They called it a graves registration detail, but that's a misnomer. Our task was to get them off the battlefield, get them back to regimental headquarters, where they could be identified, if that were possible, by their dog tags, by their initials and last name, which would be stenciled in black ink.
John Cole was 18 when he arrived on Iwo on D+5. He was assigned to gather the dead.
Typically, the bodies that we picked up had been dead anywhere from 3 to 6 days. And the reason for that is the battle went very slowly, very slowly. Anybody who tried to drag them back would themselves be killed. So it wasn't until that ground was taken and held that we could get in and recover the bodies. Because of that, the state the bodies was in was they were bloated. They were crawling with maggots. You are seriously at one point or the other going to say to yourself, I wonder if they would release me and send me into the line. It might be better to be dead than to be doing this.
While waiting for a final trip home, the dead were buried in a sea of tiny white crosses, and the battle for Iwo Jima raged on. The flag raisers from Easy Company soon suffered casualties. 1 week after planting the flag, Sergeant Mike Strank was killed by friendly fire from an offshore ship, and just hours later, a Japanese shell exploded, killing Harlan Block.
Harlan died with his intestines in his hands. He was misidentified for 2 years.
The good old boy from Hilltop, Kentucky, almost made it home. 4 weeks after the flag raising, Franklin Sousley was picked off by a sniper while waiting to be shipped out.
Three made it off: Ira Hayes, Rene Gagnon, and my dad, John Bradley.
But Doc Bradley took secrets to his grave.
These are some of the letters that we found in my dad's boxes after he died. This letter right here was written after the flag raising. In this letter, he writes, I had a little to do with raising the American flag, and it was the happiest moment of my life. We cried when we read this letter, just wondering why he had never been able to share that sentiment with us, his family.
Doc also never told anyone that he'd been awarded the Navy Cross for bravery in the battle for Iwo Jima.
My dad was the only one who had a long, normal life. Both Ira Hayes and Rene Gagnon were burnt by the hot flame of fame. Ira tried to push it away. Rene tried to pull it closer.
From the moment of its appearance on the front pages, the photograph had taken America by storm. Everyone wanted to know who the boys were, and every mother said it was her son. The White House knew it had much-needed heroes. The three surviving flag raisers do their jobs as reluctant heroes. That's next on War Stories. Barely 8 weeks after the flag raising on Suribachi, Rene Gagnon, Doc Bradley, and Ira Hayes were ordered to Washington by President Harry Truman.
And Harry told him, I want you to go on a 33-city speaking tour, 2 months, and like you to raise $14 billion. Well, how big's $14 billion in 1945? It represented 25% of the total federal budget.
At the time, the average American annual income was $1,700.
They went out on the road. The government was shocked at the response. In Boston, 200,000 people lined the streets waiting in a sleet storm just to get a glimpse of the guys going by in a jeep.
The three survivors raised the flag, frayed and battle-worn, that flew on Mount Suribachi.
The boys were mobbed everywhere they went. But when the press wanted stories of blood and guts, they didn't get any. When the boys were asked if the picture was posed, they repeatedly said no. Life in the spotlight was anything but comfortable. The boys were still thinking of their fallen comrades.
After my dad died, my mother told me that my dad cried in his sleep for the first year of their marriage. And she said, well, he would be sleeping, and tears would be coming out of his eyes, rolling down his cheeks.
Rene Gagnon developed a tic that would never go away. Back in New Hampshire, he struggled to live life as a stop-and-go hero, a VIP one day, and sweeping floors the next.
He'd be called up, asked to ride in the back of a convertible in a parade or attend halftime ceremonies at the Rose Bowl. And he'd be a big hero. And his son said it would sometimes take him 2 weeks to decompress from this experience.
And Ira Hayes drank hard.
Several of us went out with Ira Hayes, and we went to Barney Ross's bar on the Loop. That's when I noticed that Ira was He was drinking pretty good.
Do you know that it was illegal for Ira Hayes, because he was an Indian, to drink in a bar? So if Ira Hayes wanted a beer, he had to ask someone else to buy it. Ira Hayes was arrested officially 52 times for drunk and disorderly. I wish the public would see that this was a man suffering greatly.
Ira was also tormented by something else. For 2 years, Harlan Block was misidentified in the photograph. The government had insisted that the sixth flag raiser was someone else. But Ira knew the truth, and so did Harlan's mother.
This is a letter that Ira Hayes wrote to Mrs. Block, telling her that her son was on the flag raising photo. Ira felt that a boy as good as your son should not be forgotten.
And as only a mother could, Belle recognized something else.
Belle looked at her daughter and said, "Honey, I changed so many diapers on that boy's butt. I know it's my boy."
A congressional investigation belatedly cleared up the confusion, and the boy from Westlake, Texas, could finally rest in peace. As for the rest of the boys from that mountaintop, they tried to get on with their separate lives. This is their last appearance together, the 1954 unveiling of the Marine Memorial. Ira Hayes would be dead of alcohol poisoning 10 months later. Rene Gagnon would die of a heart attack at 54, and Doc Bradley would pass away at the age of 70.
Some say that young people today don't have any heroes. I say that if young people need heroes, here's a statue full of them, all young people. The youngest, 19, the oldest, just 24. A snapshot of America in 1945, about which was said that uncommon valor was a common virtue. God willing, in America, it still is. For War Stories, I'm Oliver North. Good night.